The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Greetings, robots. Humanoid Ollie Mann here to deliver another edition of Tech Weekly into your brain frames. By now, you've probably seen the headlines. Robots coming over here, taking our jobs. According to one Oxford study, up to 10 million unskilled jobs in the UK are going to be performed by machines. And in the US, it'll be almost half of the jobs market within 20 years. Well, today I'm going behind the headlines to examine the impact this automated workforce will have on our economy and our very concept of what it means to be human. I'll meet the economist Ian Stewart and Dr. Joanna Bryson, an expert in robotic ethics. And if he hasn't already been replaced by a journo droid, our tech team's Alex Hearn will be here to interview Martin Ford, author of Rise of the Robots. You will want to listen and do so autonomously. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. You're charging your battery, and now we're full of energy. We are the robots. We are the robots. The robots are coming, and they are going to radically affect how we work. But so what? Technological progress putting us all out of work? That is nothing new. Just ask the people who used to work at directory inquiries. However, what is different this time, arguably, is it could threaten to destabilise our entire economic system. Martin Ford is the author of Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of Mass Unemployment. And he argues in this new book that the growth in automation and robotics is going to have an effect on our economy, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Industrial Revolution. And I don't know about you, but my memory doesn't actually go back that far. Unlike in the 19th century, though, this upheaval is going to hit everyone, he says, from fast food servers to lawyers. And in doing so, could bring about the end of capitalism. Alex Hearn from the Tech Desk. You had a chat with Martin last week, which we're about to listen to via the magic of podcasting. But before we do, why is this book making waves at the moment?
So Martin's book is the best summation I've seen so far of the argument that the rise of automation, or you know, this second rise of automation, this digital automation, is going to be different from everything that's come before. You actually caught it. You said that what it's going to do is it's going to take away all our jobs. But we've seen that before. Well, we haven't. We've not seen anything that hit all the jobs. Every wave of automation we've seen previously, the Industrial Revolution was largely manual jobs. It hit manual labor. Automation came and took away a whole swath of back-breaking work, but it didn't do much for knowledge workers, what we call today the knowledge economy. The potential that automation has in this century is to affect everyone equally, or to affect near as damn well everyone. If everyone loses their jobs at the same time, then it's really terrible. If no one is earning money, or if, you know, only the richest machine owners in society are earning money, the engine of capitalism just breaks down.
Basically, if you're a Guardianista listening to this and you think, oh, I run a street food van, I'm a graphic designer, this won't affect me, it will affect you. Let's find out why. Here is Alex's interview with Martin Ford.
So, Martin, we're all going to lose our jobs to robot. Is that right? Is this the précis?
I think that in the long run, that's a real concern. It's not something that's going to happen, you know, within the next few years. But if we look out decades, there's no doubt that machines and algorithms are becoming much more capable and they are taking on more types of work. It's not just low-skilled manual labor anymore that's being impacted by automation. It's very often white-collar, skilled work that's being impacted by algorithms. So I do think that over the longer term, this is going to be a real issue.
But when we say future, this isn't entirely prognostication. You're saying there are aspects of this which exist in the world today. Is that right?
Yeah, there are certainly examples that you can point to. There are algorithms that can write news stories, for example, that are impacting journalists. By one account, every 30 seconds, there is a new story that appears in the media that's generated completely autonomously. And right now, I don't think that that's having a big impact on employment for journalism, but that's going to get, you know, better and better going forward. And I think that this is really an across-the-board phenomenon that's going to impact nearly every type of work in the economy. And that's the reason that I think it's likely to be very disruptive, because it's so broad-based.
If people imagine robots taking over, they imagine, you know, Terminators wandering around with guns. If it doesn't happen that way, if it does happen with algorithms and with blue-collar jobs being replaced in fast food restaurants, how visible is this going to be at the start?
Well, I think there'll be a gradual process. Right now, it's not that visible, but we could, you know, all of this is subject to an acceleration. You know, most people are familiar with Moore's Law, but things just move faster and faster. So it's entirely possible that we will at some point reach a kind of tipping point where things will begin to move much faster than what we expect.
Are there any professions which, you know, any workers who might be sitting hearing this feeling smug who are about to get a nasty surprise? Are we talking a musician might think that their job is, you know, entirely bound up in the ineffable natures of the human soul and find actually that too is going to get a nasty surprise?
Well, eventually that's certainly possible. I mean, there are already algorithms that can write symphonies. There are algorithms that can paint original works of art. So actually the whole concept of what's called creative computing is an area that's getting a lot of research now. I that's still in its infancy, but going forward, even the types of jobs that you think might be safe forever, especially in creative areas, could potentially be impacted as well. So, the thing I would say is that if you think far enough into the future, meaning decades from now, there really isn't any job at all that you can say with certainty is going to always be safe.
But we've had massive technological shifts before, and they haven't been the end of the world. What makes this different from, I mean, the most obvious example is the Industrial Revolution.
Right. I think the biggest difference is that machines are, at least in a limited sense, beginning to think now. They are taking on cognitive capability or actual brain power as opposed to just muscle power. So, you know, you can look at the Industrial Revolution, or you can look at the mechanization of agriculture is one example that's always pointed to. Those were specific mechanical technologies that really impacted one sector of the economy. And there was the whole rest of the economy out there to absorb all of those workers when it happened. Now what we're seeing is information technology is becoming really general purpose and scaling across the whole economy. And it's bringing with it this machine intelligence, this ability for machines to sort of think, to learn, to make decisions, to figure things out. You know, they're really beginning to encroach on that fundamental quality that defines human beings, our ability to think and to adapt to new situations. So that's what's really different this time.
But so I hear a lot about, you know, various smart new technologies which are supposed to be able to think. And in my daily life, I find that a lot of them are frankly a bit crap. Is there a risk we're overstating the challenge they actually pose to humanity? You know, Siri can barely understand English right now. She's not going to replace a personal assistant.
Well, I think that the immediate impact is going to be on in very specific specialized areas. So we're going to see, you know, algorithms are very capable at doing narrow specialized things. It's when we try to make them general purpose, in Siri is a good example where you're trying to have a conversation with the machine, that they tend to fall short. Although, you know, there's definitely going to be enormous progress there. But I think in the short term, it's really that specialized technology that's going to have the greatest impact. And that's not quite so visible, but it's really having an impact in workplaces already.
What do you say to the argument that although these technologies look like they might be used to replace humans, in actual fact, they'll end up working alongside? So, for instance, surgeons use technology to help them perform very complicated surgeries, and they do that in partnership with, say, robots like Da Vinci.
That's right. I mean, we definitely will see some of that. The question is that going to be the primary way this plays out? I think that in the short term, you'll see collaboration, but eventually the machines will become more and more capable so that they'll be able to replace the workers. It depends a lot on skill level too. Of course, if you're a surgeon, you've got a very high level of skill, and so you're going to probably, for the foreseeable future, be working with a robot. But if you're a fast food worker, then it's going to be quite a different story. As soon as a machine can really do everything that you can do, then you're going to be out of luck.
So one of the big differences then is the fact that this is general purpose. This affects all sectors of society. But in your book, you argue that means it affects the very fabric of capitalism itself. How does that difference play out there?
Well, the thing is that, you know, if this becomes really a across-the-board phenomenon and we start seeing unemployment or we start seeing people having their wages driven down so that they really have very little income, then that basically means that we're not going to have enough consumers out there to really purchase the products and services that are generated by the economy. And that, you know, capitalism and the market economy depend on that. You've got to have people out there who can provide that demand, which really results in economic growth and you know, by the things being produced. So there is a danger that if this really unfolds in a broad-based way, we could get into kind of a downward economic spiral or perhaps economic stagnation just because there isn't sufficient demand to really drive the economy.
But what you're describing is a world in which a lawyer can sit on the beach with a Mai Tai and still have the same amount of economic output as a world in which they spend 8 hours in the office every day. How can that be a bad thing?
Well, it wouldn't be a bad thing if we solved the distributional problem. I mean, the lawyer can sit on the beach and have that output, but the question is, does that output belong to him? Is he getting paid for it? Or does whoever owns the law firm own a machine that has replaced him and now he's got no income at all? That's the fundamental problem here. So we can imagine a very utopian future where everyone has a lot more time, nobody has to do a dangerous job. But that utopia can unfold only if we solve this issue of income distribution. If people don't have a job, then in today's world, that means they don't have an income.
So how do we move to a robot-powered world of Mai Tais on the beach?
I think the best solution that we'll have to look at eventually is some kind of a guaranteed basic income where everyone in our society will have access to some level of income, at least a minimal income, even if they can't find a traditional job. And if we move in that direction, then you can imagine a scenario where in the future machines do more and more of the work, or at least the undesirable work, and everyone still prospers because they have access to this income. Obviously, that's a very radical idea in terms of today's politics. So it would be an enormous challenge to ever realize that. But I do think that it's inevitable that we're going to have to move in that direction.
So what are the jobs which are the most safe? Which ones do you think will be hardest to automate?
Well, for the present, it will be jobs that really rely on things like creativity and human interaction and so forth. Those jobs, for the foreseeable future, are going to be relatively safe. I think a lot of jobs in healthcare specifically are very difficult to automate. If you think of a job like nursing, which requires just a tremendous amount of mobility and dexterity, as well as, you know, interaction with patients on a very human level. That package of skills is very difficult right now for us to automate.
You focus strongly on the economic outcome of all of this, but do you think there's a more philosophical one? Will this change what we focus on when we think about what it takes to be human?
Possibly. I mean, it may change our attitude toward work, for example. I mean, right now in our society, our jobs are really integral to who we are. I mean, most people derive their sense of self-worth and accomplishment and sense of contributing something from their work. If these trends kind of upend that, then we have to really rethink what it means to be a person and where you derive your satisfaction from. But I think that's an adaptation that we can manage if we understand what's coming and figure out ways to deal with it.
How long do you think it will be before we get the first robot writing a book about how robots will take all our jobs?
Well, you know, I would say not before a decade or two. I don't think we have to worry about that in the immediate future. But again, I would never say never. It could happen.
Thank you very much, Martin Ford.
Thank you.
Goodness me. Well, Alex is still with me, but also listening to all of that with us in the studio is Ian Stewart, Chief Economist at Deloitte, and Dr. Joanna Bryson, Researcher in AI and Robot Ethics at the Department of Computer Science in Bath, and currently researching at the Center for IT Policy in Princeton as well. Welcome to both of you. Ian, firstly, a report that you've just co-authored paints a slightly different picture to the one that Martin was just depicting there, you know, this kind of apocalyptic view. You conclude, in fact, technology, robots, progress will create more jobs than it destroys because that's the evidence of the last century or so.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, that phrase, it's different this time round, is one of those things that's often heard and often not proved to be the case. Overwhelmingly, history shows that technology and labour are highly complementary. And, you know, the history of the last 150 years is of phenomenal job growth in Western economies. There are three times as many jobs in America as there were in 1950 before the personal computer was invented. I mean, I think what our work does, which examines census data over the last 150 years to try to understand how technology changes the volume and composition of work. What it does is shows that there's an obvious effect of technology, which is it destroys some jobs, and agriculture and manufacturing are very good examples. But then there are creative channels, and one is that new technologies themselves require people, app designers and scientists, that new technology is often highly complementary with labour. And the final channel is that technology just makes stuff cheaper. I mean, I think that's one of the, the real basic things. It makes stuff cheaper, it gives consumers more spending power, and they go out and spend it on all sorts of extraordinary things that we couldn't dream of, like overpriced coffees and gym membership, and that creates new work. Yeah, that's what the history says, and I think that's probably going to be the history of the next century in terms of jobs.
So why is it then that the debate is skewed towards job destruction? Is it just an innate feeling of paranoia that we have?
It's a really fascinating question, and obviously it's always been there. It's always been there, and every generation believes they're observing the most transformational technology. You know, you can go back and read books from 100 years ago in which we all think that we're on the verge of remarkable change. I think the reason the debate's skewed is because the destructive properties of technology are highly visible and they are relatively easily forecastable. And we've actually had work commissioned by academics at Oxford to try to identify which jobs are going to get chopped in the next 20 years. And that the more interesting question is to work out what jobs are going to be created. Nobody's got a clue. And I think that it's the imbalance between the certainty of destruction and the unpredictability of creation which creates this angst, which has been around since the Industrial Revolution.
Okay. Joanna Bryson, nobody has a clue. I mean, hopefully, working in AI, you have a clue. What we're hearing here true, that there will be jobs for people once the robots take over? Or in your view, actually, is it not true that there'll be as many jobs as certainly Martin was suggesting?
Well, I wouldn't want to argue economics with an economist yet. I'm going to read up on it a little bit. But what I think the basic question is there's two things that are happening. One is this inequality, the growing inequality. In the United States, one-fifth of people are on food stamps. I mean, that's amazing. So what they're getting paid is not enough that they can reliably eat. On the other end, people like you and I, people in higher education and journalism, we're under threat of automation for the first time. So then we write stories about it, but probably we'll have good jobs. And I actually agree with what Ian was saying, that technology will keep affording us opportunities, but partly through our own creativity and not necessarily the kinds of jobs we were originally expecting. So one of the cool things in Martin Ford's book is he does a good job of looking at what's actually out there already. So a lot of these changes are already happening. You know, technology, AI has been in Google since, 1998 or something, right? So a lot of things already are changing and we're kind of slow to notice that it's happened already. iPhones are robots. You know, iPhones are perceiving you and trying to get you what you need all the time. So, some huge proportion of people have smartphones. It doesn't have to be an iPhone. They're literally those domestic robots you were looking for. Okay. And this is actually, I was going to disagree with Martin Ford about that the surgeons were in less danger than the fast food. You can hire people to do fast food for less, where surgeons get a lot of money. So the tricky part of robotics, a lot of the manipulation and things, we have more motivation to replace a surgeon because we can get more money per surgeon replaced than for a fast food person.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that people are unsettled about, isn't it, Ian? I mean, I was looking at a précis of your Deloitte report into this, and it was saying how over the years, actually, yes, we've lost agricultural jobs, for example, but jobs in caring and hairdressers have gone up and service-based things. And actually, that's good because it means people interact in a slightly warmer way rather than just doing hard labour. But actually, sorry to bring this down to a very pedestrian level, but the thing people see on a daily basis that they're conscious of in terms of AI is probably things like automated supermarket checkouts, that frustrating, unidentified bag in the bagging area or whatever it is. Now, that thing, that isn't providing a more caring service, a more compassionate service, a more human service than when someone was working there. In terms of pleasure, it's not helping me as a customer.
I think it's a very good point. I mean, I think ultimately, what is the source of value or utility to humans? And I think there is an insatiable human desire for contact with other people, for interaction. The sort of fundamental economic problem is that desires are limitless and resources are fixed. And what technology does is, by driving efficiency and productivity, it enables us to do more.
This question about kiosks, I have to say that personally, I am one of the people who goes and stands in however long the line is to get the one human, partly because of my guilt over having created AI in that way to get people to lose their jobs, but more because if you go to a train station or something where it's fully automated and then something wrong happens, like the train blows through and you know the driver forgot, there's no one there to help you. It's important that we keep people employed because they can handle exceptions in ways that machines can't handle exceptions.
So the future is robotic, however you look at it, whether you find that exciting or terrifying. I suppose the question next is, how are we going to cope with it on both a personal level and a governmental level? We'll be discussing that after this.
If you've got a mobile business, you need an easy way to take multiple payment types with one integration. With Braintree, you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more. Braintree also has quick, knowledgeable developer support, so there's help whenever you need it. The Braintree V.0 SDK, one snippet of code and you're all set up and ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. To find out more and for your first £30,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly.
So what will our lives be like when our leaders are replaced by robotic overlords? The conversation continues. Dr. Joanna Bryson, Ian Stewart and Alex Hearn still with me now. And Alex, in the wider tech community, obviously there's a lot of innovation going on. And we've talked in the past about, for example, why are Google doing driverless cars? You know, is it to make them look innovative and cutting edge? Or is it as a platform to sell more advertising when we have people sitting there looking at screens? In other words, is the motivation really, let's see where the technology takes us? Is it a genuine desire in the tech industry, do you think, to evolve in this way?
I think the tech industry is, by and large, very short-sighted. I think it's almost the definition of the distinction between the tech industry and academics, is that the tech industry is focused very much on taking what we already have and finding a way to get it in a package that can be sold to someone. At the same time, there are a surprising amount of people in companies like Google and Facebook, in the great titans of the tech age, who do seem to be motivated by very little other than what's cool and what they can do. And, you know, they're run by boy geniuses who like the idea of throwing significant portions of their wealth at these, I mean, Google even calls them these moonshots.
Yeah, I do wonder whether sometimes this technology is developed by people who don't necessarily have the best interpersonal skills. So they're not thinking about a real world application where people actually want to speak to a human.
Well, I mean, one of my favorite pithy one-liners knocking down Silicon Valley is that it's an entire industry built by 20-something men trying to replace what their mothers did for them with technology. So it's why you go to San Francisco and there is Uber for your laundry and there is Uber for picking up your kids from school, and there are all kinds of on-demand applications which will replicate what a mother used to do for domestic labor. The thing I find really interesting about this, though, is that Martin Ford's argument is strong, but it's the strongest form of the argument. And actually, maybe it's not different from last time, but last time, if we're talking about the Industrial Revolution, was a pretty bloody big upheaval. And it's not entirely clear, if you were standing in 1830 and could see what was about to happen, that you wouldn't want to go, okay, maybe we can, you know, slow this down, make it happen over a longer period of time or manage it better. You know, the 1840s, the 1850s were quite unpleasant for, it seems, most people living in it. Even if we do think it's going to be like it was last time, that's not entirely comforting.
Yeah, I mean, Ian, the number one job for men in the US is truck driving. So there's going to be political upheaval, isn't there? What do we do about that?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, one of the reasons I'm an optimist about this is because I think societies and political systems are, in free societies, evolve and they change and they adapt. And if you look at one of the big changes in the industrialized world, the rich world in the last 150 years, it's been in the growth of the state. So the state was very small in the mid-19th century. I mean, it was really principally about waging wars and levying taxes and a degree of sort of internal control. Today, in most rich countries, the state accounts for 30%, 40% of GDP. I mean, the demographic system has enabled us to create this vast machine for taxing and reallocating wealth through the welfare system. So, yeah, it's very interesting at the moment. There's a really live debate about the minimum wage in the States. And, of course, we've had a Conservative Chancellor in the UK, surprise, surprise, announcing a five-year program to raise the minimum wage at a far faster rate of than inflation. And you know, where I would completely agree with Martin Ford is there's a huge issue around the distribution of wealth and income in the economy. And I think that raises very big political questions.
Yeah, but he doesn't just say there's an issue. He says, and here's a solution. The government will give you a guaranteed basic income. I mean, Alex and he only touched on that part of his book, but it's a massive political theory, that, isn't it? He's talking about a kind of massive redistribution of wealth. Is that something you could see happening in the next 100 years?
We have a massive redistribution of wealth in this country. I mean, Social Security accounts for around about 40-50% of government expenditure. And for a sizable portion of the population, the state is their principal provider of income. And, you know, this is obviously one of the, you know, a bit like our robots going to steal your jobs. The question about the size of the state is one of those perennial questions, and it goes in cycles. And I guess the state is contracting at the moment, and it's contracting across the industrialized world. But I think that is a very legitimate argument. And you know, we have through something like the Working Families Tax Credit, massive way of subsidizing low paid work.
Yeah, except ironically, when the government do devise a computer system for benefits, they always balls it up, don't they? Joanna, you're someone who works across Europe and the United States. Should our bosses be thinking about adapting to this change in the workplace?
It's not so much about in the workplace itself. It is a different model of how are you going to run your life. So again, one of the nice things about Martin Ford's book is the discussion he has about higher education. And the fact that you do need to be able to keep re-educating yourself at any point, but maybe you don't need that 4 years up front.
But what about at school level? I mean, never mind further education, actually. Are we in danger of educating children for an age where they're going to be working in factories, not where they're going to be servicing computers?
Again, I'm not an expert in current school policy, but what we ought to be doing is we ought to be teaching both at the school level and at university level, people to learn how to learn. They need to be able to constantly be able to put themselves and be confident to put themselves into new situations. And they shouldn't expect to be going into their grandfather's or grandmother's avocation.
Well, one thing the government is doing, and they get some criticism for this over the last 5 or 10 years, is they've been measuring happiness, haven't they? There's this index to see how happy we all are. And I just wonder when, you know, people like you, Joanna, academically are discussing what could happen, right, whether you're really thinking about what should in terms of human happiness and a sense of self-worth in doing a job. Are there some jobs that robots shouldn't do, that we shouldn't be trying to develop them into?
Well, there are issues around that I worry about in terms of security and privacy and individual well-being, capacity to be different from other people, things like that. But otherwise, I actually am a pretty much a believer in a regulated capitalist environment. We won't put robots into places where people don't think they're a good idea. But that it has to be a cooperative. It isn't just about companies and what you can do technologically. It is also about citizens saying that's not a product that we want for the variety of reasons. But the only time I think, while you really can't go there, is when it is something that really hurts either our liberty as citizens or the security of our country and our companies.
And Alex, I want to come back to you to ask you about something you were talking to Martin about right at the beginning of the interview, which was journalism. You know, computers taking your job, my job.
I'm actually a robot.
exactly. It made me think of Nick Delossio. Do you remember him? Teenage wunderkind, made millions of pounds and a name for himself by selling Sumly, which was his auto-summarization news tool to Yahoo. And then they brought out the app, and it's very good. It's called Yahoo News Digest. I've got it on my phone. But it turns out it isn't actually being run by computers. It's using a bit of his technology, but actually there's a human curator choosing what are the 10 most important news stories and checking that there's nothing libelous in there. Actually, aren't there always going to have to be human checks and balances on jobs like that? If we put out a podcast now and we were both robots and then The Guardian put its name on it and there was a lawsuit, it would be worse, wouldn't it, if The Guardian had employed a robot to do the show than me? Because they can blame me. They can't really blame the programmer.
It's tricky. I mean, you know, the nuts and bolts answer to that is, well, if The Guardian can put out 10 times as many podcasts and one in 10 of them gets a lawsuit, but that one lawyer fighting that one lawsuit is still cheaper than the salary for 10 hosts, then maybe it works out anyway. There's a very blunt cost benefit analysis to be made there. But I do think actually that the automation in journalism is the strong argument for technology as a complement to labor. Yeah, like there are a few companies which set out to make fully automated news reporting. The most popular areas are finance journalism and sports. All of this could happen slowly, but it's the slow aspect of it. One day that will be a good technology. It will be there. A robot might be able to do it, and then we'll be that one step closer to the Star Trek economy. This only really becomes, and I'm sure Ian will correct me if I'm wrong, it only really becomes a massive economic issue if it doesn't happen slowly, if it happens quickly, you know, within a generation. If it takes 20 or 30 years for sports journalists to be completely replaced, that's probably a bad thing, because that means that the whole of society will be in upheaval. But if it takes another 100 years for AI to become good enough to pass Twitter reports of a sports game to write a fully detailed match report, then in that time, there'll already have been several generations of people switching.
Judging by some of the press conferences I see around football matches, I'm not entirely sure that the managers haven't all been replaced by drones already. Ian, how do you respond to that, though, the speed of change being very important to how society sort of takes this to heart?
Yes, I think that one area where I think I might have concerns is that I think you can show that the speed of adoption of technologies has picked up. And so I suppose the implication is that maybe the pace of change in the economy is picking up. I mean, that's one of those things we always hear, that, you know, the pace of change is unprecedented. Unfortunately, we can't find really strong evidence in the labour market that that's true. So often assertions are made based on personal experience, without any understanding of what the past was like. Can I just make a point about Twitter? One of the things with Twitter is that you end up following an individual, and you want to follow that individual because you think that person is wise and insightful. And I think like a kind of Turing test for today would be to come up with a robot that was so clever that it could generate Twitter stories, and I think I want to follow that robot. My guess is, I mean, I'm no expert on AI, but I guess we're a long way from producing those kind of technologies.
Joanna, are we a long way?
I don't think so. I think the New York Times is already doing its social media editing by algorithm. So sorry about that one. The people keep thinking that you can back away into, oh, that's creative or something like that, but actually, We, as Martin Ford said, we're doing pretty well at creative.
And for everyone who's listening to this who isn't a journalist or an academic or an economist, actually, I mean, all of us, I'm guessing, enjoy our jobs. There's a lot of people out there listening to this who would much rather be a songwriter, but actually go to an office every day and do something they really hate. Is it time we have to change our attitude to how we think about our lives at work as defining us?
Right. There was a few things that have been said that I've been wondering about. A lot of the world, people aren't able to work because they're the wrong gender, or they're too old, or they're from the wrong background, and of course because they just aren't competent to be employed. So a lot of us have identified and understood ourselves in other ways, and you know, in our context of our families, as artists, whatever the other thing is. And one of the things you asked about a while ago, actually at this point, was will we get more time? Will this give us all more time? A lot of us could have a lot more time now, and we choose to work more hours than we should because we're competitive. And I think that's one of the things that's not going to change. People will keep finding ways to express themselves, and whether it's gardening or raising lots of kids or working, you know, in second and third jobs, I think people will always do that. That's a very basic primate dynamic, and we should release and encourage people to find different things that they can express themselves in and different forms of identity.
Yeah, I guess some of the time limits we impose upon things are arbitrary, including the ones we put on this podcast, but we have run out of it. So I suppose I should thank you very much. Absolutely fascinating stuff, Dr. Joanna Bryson from Bath University and Princeton, the economist Ian Stewart from Deloitte, and Martin Ford, author of Rise of the Robots, talking to Alex Hearn from the Tech Desk. That is it from me, Ollie Mann. The producer has been Alana Chance, and we will see you next week.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.